My name is Alaska Woods. I am 20 years old, and my pronouns are they, them. Today is June 17th, 2023, and we are in Colorado Springs, Colorado. My interview partner's name is Ashton, and they are 21 and use they, them pronouns, and they are my partner, my significant other.
Hello. All right, to kick things off, how does the intersectionality of disability affect the space you take up in queer communities?
I'd say it changes it drastically for me. Everything I do, especially in the queer community, is impacted by my disability. It impacts the way I move around as a physically disabled person, and it impacts how I can show up to places. And I'm sure I'll talk about this a lot, but masks are very important to me, wearing, a mask for COVID-19, because getting COVID-19 has either created or progressed my disability significantly. So I oftentimes can't even show up to queer spaces because they are not masked, because they are not taking COVID precautions, and because of that, I just don't feel welcome there. So I don't always take up space there because I can't. How do you think that same question impacts you?
So a lot of queer spaces usually focus primarily on the fact that they are queer spaces and not on making accessible to all communities. And so me being cognitively disabled, I struggle with, going to spaces that are loud, that have a lot of people, that are very visually stimulating. And so a lot of queer spaces are generally Pride is a huge celebration most of the time in a lot of places. It makes it really hard because I'm from the South. And so my opportunities to be in queer spaces and to be surrounded by queer people are really limited. And it's not necessarily that I don't feel welcome in the spaces. Being there, I'm appreciated, but they don't ever think of me when they set those up. And I think that you feel very similarly, because, a lot of queer places are we're celebrating at this place, but it doesn't have a ramp. They never have a ramp. And same thing for me. It's they're always, loud and overwhelming, and you kind of enter the space and you feel welcome as a queer person, but, another half of my identity is completely, not thought about or considered. And, and when you ask people who plan these events, will I be welcome here? They say you are welcome here, but they don't ever plan for you, if that makes sense.
They will always say you're welcome, but I never feel welcome.
Yeah. They say you're welcome, but they don't. Their actions speak louder than words, if that makes sense.
They don't do anything to welcome you.
Yeah.
they want to be welcoming, I think. They want to be there, but they don't want to put in the effort to actually make it welcoming.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting that you said you feel welcome, because I never do.
I don't necessarily feel welcome. I probably should have worded that better, but I feel as if they want me to be there because they want to feel like they're a diverse space, and they want to, but they think that since they're accepting of queer people, they're inherently accepting of all marginalized communities, which is not inherently true.
Yeah. And it's interesting how you say that, and how it's almost like it's not that they necessarily want us there, and maybe they do. I think a lot of times they do, but sometimes they just want to be able to say that we're there, because it's some kind of badge of honor to be there are disabled people here, which is fine. It is a good thing to have disabled people there, but you have to put in the effort. You have to work to make it accessible. And I also thought it was interesting how you talked about loud spaces and overstimulating spaces. Because I also struggle with sensory issues, maybe not to the extent that you do, but I've been there with you at many places. And some of them I struggle in, and some of them I don't, but I always see you struggle.
Yeah.
And I never see anyone do anything about it.
Yeah. Something that I find particularly interesting about it is how integral the experience of being queer is reliant on disabled people. Mm-hmm. you know, obviously with like the HIV and AIDS, all that stuff that happened. Obviously, I wasn't there. I'm much younger than that. But that, you know, is a mass disabling event. And being disabled is an integral part of queer history. And similarly, there is a huge overlap between the rates of autism and the rates of, you know, gender diversity. And so it's one of those things where it's like, you know, being disabled is such a integral part of being queer, you know, even if you're not disabled yourself, you owe so much of your experience and so much of your well-being to disabled people.
Yeah.
You know?
I think the history with disability, and I mean, truly any intersection, I believe you can find a beautiful history, but specifically with disability and queerness, is to think about that really breaks my heart because of how our community has come out of the pandemic and not done anything about it. And I think about our brothers, sisters, and siblings in our community who have HIV or AIDS and are immunocompromised and cannot go to things. And they are like, they are just as important as anyone who can go to anything, who can be there unmasked and be there untested. And it's hard for me because I have felt very left behind. And I can't even imagine someone who literally, like, has something, a disability that's so ingrained in queer history and is also left behind. And it breaks my heart to see how quickly we've forgotten about them.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where very much earlier on in the pandemic, I feel like queer spaces were some of the first places to stop masking, particularly like clubs and parties and Pride. Because I don't know why they stopped doing it. All their reasoning was like, it's safe now. And I'm like, you know. And so it's one of those things where you're kind of just, you know, metaphorically on your knees begging and pleading to be allowed in a space that tries to emphasize, you know, being welcoming and being encouraging of these marginalized communities. But as soon as it inconveniences them to any degree, they don't want you there, you know.
And it's hard because sometimes I feel I have almost literally begged them. Not necessarily on my hands and knees, but I understand that sometimes people are ignorant even within their own communities. And I truly try to educate people. And I truly try to sit down with them and meet them where they're at and say, this is what I need to be there. And you are not doing it.
Right.
And sometimes they still will not listen.
Yeah.
And that's something else that breaks my heart because I literally will be like, if you do not mask, I cannot come.
Right. For and sure.
They are not willing to put that mandate in place to inconvenience other people to have me there. And I think that speaks volumes.
Yeah, for sure. And also, you know, building on that as well is the you know, the idea that, like, I feel like a lot of queer people assume that because a space doesn't necessarily belong, they assume that a space belongs to them specifically and it's not a shared space. Mm. The queer identity is a shared identity. It doesn't belong to just one person.
Mm-hmm.
And so as soon as someone finds that another person in their community doesn't necessarily, not necessarily makes them uncomfortable, but inconveniences them to any extent, they get very, very upset about it. And I think that that's an experience that's, you know, seen over a lot of marginalized communities where as soon as, you know, an experience isn't exactly the same as, like, you know, cis white queer people, they don't want to be a part of it because it makes them uncomfortable. And they assume that because they are also part of that community, it doesn't deserve to be there because it makes them uncomfortable.
And it's wild because it's the same thing that cis straight people have done to us.
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating to watch that happen again and again in intersectionality, whether it be disability or, you know, a person of color's intersectionality or anything. You know, it happens again and again, and it's so frustrating to watch, and I know there are reasons for that, and I've learned about those reasons a little bit, but It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. And I feel like every time I've had, you know, a heart-to-heart discussion with people who either I know very well or don't know super well, their response to why they don't mask anymore is just, like, they don't ever have a solidified reasoning, you know? It's like, mm-hmm. they're like, I agree with you morally. I agree with you that this is the right thing to do. I agree with you that you deserve to be welcome in this space and you deserve to be accommodated for this space.
But I won't do that. And I will say, like, I think it is important to say that there are some disabled people who can't wear masks, and that's not ever what I'm talking about.
Yeah, for sure.
Is people who can't wear them for any, like, true reason. But I'm talking about the people who are abled or whose disability do not impact their ability to wear a mask and who refuse to wear it simply because it is an inconvenience to them.
Yeah.
And it teaches me that the moment I am an inconvenience as a disabled person, I am not welcome.
For sure.
And I think that speaks beyond masks. I think it speaks about if there were an emergency and I'm in my wheelchair and I can't run out of a place, they will not stop to get me.
Yeah.
Because if they can't put something on their face for a few hours,
yeah,
then why would they ever save me in an emergency?
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's kind of what it feels like, you know, with, obviously this is not nearly to the same extent, but with autism in queer spaces and those loud queer spaces, it's one of those things where it's like, they will never choose my comfort and my well-being over their own joy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They will always choose pleasure over the well-being of the people around them. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously, like, you know, people who want those spaces and deserve those spaces, or people who want those spaces and need those spaces deserve them, but it's...
But they'll never build a space for you.
Yeah, they're never... The intentions are never for me as an individual. It's either for, you know, they feel pressured into it, or, you know... It's never actually out of the kindness of their own hearts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's never... feels like, I mean, there are people who I meet who
yeah.
care, but it feels like the greater community does not care, and the only times they are is out of social pressure.
Yeah.
And it's hard to be, like, to have to use that social pressure and have to pull that card and be like, listen, you're not being intersectional.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't have to do that. I should be included because they want me there.
Yeah. And it's upsetting because I feel like, you know, my experiences in and of themselves are valuable in queer spaces, but they only want the experiences and they only want the presence of people who make them comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it so hard because, you know, although you don't see them anywhere because they're never accepted, is, like, the disabled queer community is huge. Like,
it is huge.
There's a huge online community. There's a huge, you know, there's a huge population of disabled and queer people because, you know, there's a huge overlap between those two populations. But, you know, they're never welcome in spaces, and so you never see them anywhere.
Yeah. I will say that, like, my life has truly been made smaller because of the ignorance of people towards disability, because they are unwilling to create spaces for us. So, like, there are so many things I've wanted to go to and so many things I've wanted to be a part of that I simply could not because yeah. they refused to include us.
For sure. And it's one of those things where, you know, they say that they want you there and you ask if it's going to be accessible. You ask if you go to them and you ask, am I allowed in this space? Are you going to make space for me? And they say, yes, of course. And you get there and it's never accessible. I cannot name, like, any event I've ever been to that has been legitimately accommodating.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah. And it's not that they have to change the fabric of everything. And some events there are. They
yeah.
are just going to always be inaccessible. But there are accommodations they could make.
Yeah.
And they refuse to make them. They refuse to even sit down and ask, what do you need?
Yeah.
And if they do that, they won't do it, like, what you need. Because
yeah.
I will sit down and be like, I need masks. And they're like, well, they're recommended, but we cannot mandate them. And I'm like, why can't you mandate them? This is your event.
Right. What happened to, like, 2 years ago when you were mandating them and then you changed your mind?
Yeah.
It's like, how'd you do that 2 years ago? What happened? Like, where did Jimmy the Mask Guy go?
Yeah. I don't understand what happened. And it's hard. And I, something, you know, that really hit me this year and has, like, hit me over and over and over is that I, like, I'm losing my community.
Yeah.
Because when the Pulse, not Pulse, I'm sorry, that was so long ago. When Club Q happened, just, if, you know, like, 6 months ago, there were so many events for queer people to heal.
Yeah.
And I could not go to them.
Yeah.
I was left to grieve alone.
Yeah.
Because they refused to make accommodations for me.
Yeah, for sure. And they'll never... When you address these, like, when you address them in person about, like, situations not being accommodating, they'll always, like, kind of pull something out of their back pocket and be like, oh, you know, this, it's this guy's fault. They'll never take the blame for it. They'll never say, oh, I'm so sorry, let me fix this. You know?
I recently saw, I can't remember where or what for, but I recently, oh, I do remember. I, it was when we were, we took a road trip this summer to move you out here, and we went through St. Louis, and the arch, we were going to go to the St. Louis Arch, and it was honest.
Yeah, they were straight up.
We could not go there because you'd have to climb stairs, you'd have to stand, you'd have to do X, Y, Z, and it is wrong that that was inaccessible in the first place, and they need to change it.
Yeah.
But it's frustrating for everyone you ask to say, this is accessible.
Yeah.
And they use that word like a shield, and they say, oh, this is accessible, and it never is. And I almost wish they would say, listen, this isn't accessible.
Right.
And we know it. And we know we are leaving you out. And you cannot come. Because, yeah, like, at least be honest with me.
Yeah.
Because, and one of my biggest, like, I hate when I ask, like, is this event accessible? And they'll go, yes, but masks aren't mandated, there's stairs here, there's this here, like, there's always something. It's like, don't say it's accessible if it's not.
Yeah. All right, sorry about that. We had to take a pause because it started hailing and it got really loud. But it was a good point to kind of section off to another topic of point. But I wanted to touch on the experiences of, like, cognitive disabilities in the queer community. So are you ready to move on to that? Okay. So something that I've noticed a lot within the queer community is that, you know, part of being queer is that you're just going to be disliked by people. That is an inherent part of the experience. And also with being autistic, that is also part of the autistic experience, but for different reasons. You know, my social skills aren't the greatest. There are aspects of myself that are off-putting that I can't change about myself. But, you know, I kind of always find that people are going to find something that they dislike about me that isn't, you know, a flaw. You know, I can't make eye contact all the time, but that doesn't make me a bad person or a dislikable person. I have bizarre speech patterns. I speak very calculatedly, and a lot of people really will, you know, dislike me for that.
It goes back to, like, how the moment something makes someone uncomfortable, they're willing to let go of their values.
And it shows how a lot of people, you know, develop their values based off of social pressure and not based off of their own moral compass. And it's really difficult because, you know, a lot of people will be talking to, like, other queer people, and they'll say, oh, you're not one of, you know, those gays, you know, and they're usually implying, like, annoying or off-putting, and, you know, it's one of the, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, so this is an aspect of myself that I can't change, and you don't like it.
So what do you do?
So what do I do? And it's one of those things where, you know, people will always say mean things about you, but they'll never say it's because you're autistic.
Yeah.
They'll say, like, they say they're just weird, they're off-putting, I don't like being around them, they're just too much to handle.
And they get mad when you call them out on it.
Yeah.
Because, do you remember that time, there was, like, a trend of, like, people being like, oh, I found, so, on TikTok, do you remember that time, there was this video that was, like, oh, I found someone you might, I know a gay person you might be interested in. And yeah. then it was like, oh, this, like, listing traits. And then it was like, oh, well, I don't like that kind of gay person.
Right. And all of the traits were just of cognitively disabled people.
Yes. And I made a video calling that out. And I was like, hey, you are listing autistic traits. Like, you are literally just being ableist right now. And you might not know that, but you need to stop. And I will be honest, like, that person said, yes, like, I was in the wrong and I'm sorry. But they did not take down that video.
Yeah.
Because it did very well. And I got a ton of backlash.
Yeah.
I got so many people mad at me to the extent where I went private, like, changed my username. Like,
yeah.
There are people, like, reposting my video, like, doing, like, things about it. And it was scary. And so it's just interesting.
Yeah.
So that's what comes to mind when you talk about that is, like,
yeah. And, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the rate of queerness and autism really, really overlap. And so, mm-hmm. like, there is a huge part of the queer community that is autistic or, you know, have other variations of cognitive disabilities. And, you know, people will be like, oh, you know, you're just not one. We just don't like you, you know. And that's always what it is. I just don't like you. And, you know, I don't need everyone in the world to like me, but they'll never respect me, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, terrible because, you know, my experiences, as I said earlier, are valuable and I deserve to take up space in my own community, mm-hmm. even if it's not wanted.
Yeah.
And so there's this kind of, what's the word? They see themselves as better than you, you know. It's like, I'm gay, but at least I'm not like those.
Like you.
And it's like, okay, so I was born with this. Mm-hmm. I was born autistic. I was born queer. And these are both parts of my experience and identity. And I cannot get rid of it. I cannot change it. And the fact that you see me as an inherently flawed individual over something that I cannot change, or, you know, even if I did choose it, even if I chose to be queer, even if I chose to be autistic, what is so bad about who I am as a person that I do not deserve to be in this space?
And it makes me think about how, like, isolated I feel from the queer community as a disabled person.
Yeah.
And I know there are a lot of intersections where people feel like on both sides they're giving up something. But luckily, in a lot of disabled spaces, I feel very welcome because I feel like there are a lot of queer disabled people. And it's almost like you have to find that intersection and just live within it.
Yeah.
But it's like, I should be able to go to queer events and you should be able to go to queer events with people who are not disabled and still be there. But I often feel like I have to just be with disabled queer people.
Yeah.
Because they're the only people who will understand what I'm going through or even care enough about to take precautions I need and give me accommodations I need. And it like, separates us further from our own community.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I can only exist in places with people like me, and I want to be with non-disabled queer people.
Yeah.
But they won't include us.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's, like, most queer events aren't hosted by just queer people themselves. It's usually hosted by, like, queer community, like, community centers or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And they never put, you know, anyone other than just, like, able-bodied white queer people in their planning kind of thing.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's, I want to be surrounded by, you know, different queer people because there's, you know, like, there's other marginalized communities besides disabled queer people, and I want to get to know them. But, you know, in order for me to be taken seriously and to be welcome into a space, it has to be within autistic queer spaces or disabled queer spaces, mm-hmm. you know? And that's so limited. Like,
yeah. And it's also interesting how even within the disabled community, it can be fractured.
Yeah.
Because even like, physically disabled spaces may not accommodate cognitively disabled people,
right.
and vice versa.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think a lot about how I've seen disabled people online who don't mask.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, so queer people won't mask for me. Like, obviously, like, the main populace won't mask for me. And then it's like, even disabled people, some of them won't mask. Because, again, it just doesn't affect them. But, like, as a chronically ill person, that's something I need. And it's frustrating that, like, it feels like no matter where you turn, they turn you away.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where it's just, you know, when you're disabled, you have to take so many more steps to do anything, you know. Mm-hmm. For me, I have to emotionally prepare to go to the store. You have to physically prepare to go to the store. You have to get your wheelchair out. We have to, you know, get your wheelchair into the car. We have to get you into your wheelchair. We have to get from point A to point B. We have to get into the store. And then, oh, no, the store has stairs. We have to go somewhere else. And it's one of those things where getting people to mask, getting people to lower the volume, getting people to, you know, have less intense lights, doing all those things, it's just another step. And since COVID, I feel like it's gotten even harder for disabled people to find those spaces, because now there's less spaces for, you know, disabled people to exist in.
And because of the pandemic, I feel like people are so exhausted by it that they yeah. just want to be like, oh, fuck it, I don't care.
Yeah,
I'm just sure. gonna, like, do XYZ, and I'm over it, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, well, it's my life. Like, I can't be over it.
Yeah. And you've had it, like, 4 times, haven't you? And every time.
3 or 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, every time it's gotten worse.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that the sickness itself got worse, but it has probably impacted my disability.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just, like, it's just hard. And I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I have also been thinking about throughout this conversation how we are kind of unique in that, like, you have a little bit of experience with being, like, struggling with physical disability,
yeah.
less so than me. And then I have, like, a little bit of experience being cognitively disabled,
yeah.
less so than you.
Yeah.
Which is something I've just been thinking about, and I don't know if you want to talk about it. But
I think it... So this should not be the way that you develop empathy for other people, but I think that it's why you and I work well together.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I struggle with my fine motor skills. I really struggle with, you know, turning knobs, opening doors, anything that requires, you know, really intricate hand motions and stuff like that, and I struggle much more in, you know, socialization and stuff associated with, you know, mm-hmm. autism. And
I'm pretty good with social stuff, but I obviously struggle with all of my physical disability. But
yeah.
I also, you know, I'm not, like, diagnosed, or I'm not even solidified in the fact that I have autism, but, like, I've definitely felt certain aspects of it, like my, tendency to have extreme empathy and
yeah
things like that. So it's kind of interesting how we know a little bit about each other's worlds through experience, but I also feel like we do our best to, like, know just because we love each other and to, you know, take the time to learn and take the time to change our minds because we love each other. And that's what the community should be doing for us.
Yeah, for sure. Because it's my moral compass isn't shaped by the fact that it's what everyone else is doing. It's not shaped by the fact that I think that that's what I should be doing. It's shaped by the fact that I love you and the fact that I love the people around me and I want them to be okay. And that's, I think, where people struggle to argue against it.
Because
mm-hmm. They say, oh, it's safe, I'm willing to take the risk for myself. And, you know, when we say, no, it's not because I'm selfish. It's not because I want to be okay. It's because I love the people around me and I want the people I encounter on a daily basis to be okay. And I want them to feel welcome and I want them to feel loved, because I would never want to put, you know, the way that I'm... I would never want to put anyone through the way that I'm treated.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And I'd agree that, like, my moral compass is guided not by social, what would you call that? By social
pressure,
but by love.
Yeah.
And I wish everyone was like that.
Yeah.
And I'd like to believe that everyone is to some extent, but it's also disheartening and frustrating and feels like it's not that way when you beg people to do things for you and they say no.
Yeah. And it's just, it's heartbreaking because it's, you know, I recognize that I personally struggle with empathy. I'm not very good at, like, feeling things.
But it's not about empathy, it's about compassion.
Yes.
Because empathy is something that not everyone can, has right. or has access to or, can do. But I feel that most people have the ability to at least, I don't know. Can you speak on that a little bit? Yeah. I don't know if that's my place, but,
So, it's just because I don't personally feel all that much mm-hmm. emotion doesn't mean that I'm not aware, that I care about these people, you know? When
you
I see someone...
You can still listen and change your yeah. actions.
Regardless
of if you feel it.
Yeah. So I see this guy at the grocery store, and I don't know who he is. You know, he could, trip and fall, and I wouldn't be personally impacted it, but, I want him to be okay. I want him to be well. Mm-hmm. And, replace tripping and falling with getting sick with COVID and becoming disabled, I want the people around me to be okay, because I wouldn't want the negative parts of our experiences on anyone else,
Mm-hmm. It's a hard intersection. I think all intersections are hard, but it's something we live in, something that I struggle with, and something that I find really beautiful as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having this conversation with me. I
really loved it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was really good to kind of put that all out there.
Yeah, thank you. It was cool to talk about and to have recorded and to really go into it and to have it with you. I'm so glad I had it with
yeah.
you. because, I was thinking about different people to have it with, and I thought, maybe because we talk so much and because we've talked about this so much, it might be tired, but it wasn't. It was really good. So
yeah.
Thank you, and I love you.
Of course. I love you, too.